Hi, I'm Emily Solaby, founder of Juno Jones, the stylish safety boot company, and your host on the Hazard Girls podcast here on Jacket Media. I'm so honored to host this show where I get to chat with Hazard Girls about their careers. Hazard Girls is an online community for women working in traditionally male-dominated fields. On our show, you'll get to hear from these amazing women about the path that led them to their current careers, challenges they've overcome, advice for other women in entering these industries, and more.
Helen Sarah Johnson is doctoral researcher with Loughborough University, an HR business partner with Manufacturing Technology Center High Value Manufacturing Catapult, which is part of the UK Catapult Network. Sarah has over 20 years of experience working in global engineering and manufacturing organizations. She holds her BA, her MA, and her LLM, and is currently working on her PhD, exploring the conflict female engineers may experience between their gender and professional identities, and the impact that this identity conflict causes at work. She's also a contributing author in the upcoming book, Empowering Women in STEM, Working Together to Inspire the Future by Sonia Mathura. Fascinated by both identity and authenticity, Helen's PhD explores the conflict female engineers may experience between their gender and professional identity, the impact this identity conflict causes at work, and aims to shed light on the role authenticity plays in this relationship. If you resonate with holding multiple identities and the challenge to be authentically you, Helen's story is one you cannot afford to miss. Welcome to the Hazard Girls podcast, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And before I get started, I do want to thank Sonia Mathura, who is the founder of Strategic Reliability Solutions and the editor of the new book, Empowering Women in STEM, Working Together to Inspire the Future. Sonia has assembled over 20 authors to create this masterpiece, which is due out March 1st. And we will talk later in the episode about where you can get your hands on that. Juno Jones Safety Boots and the Hazard Girls podcast have partnered with Sonia and the book to interview each of the authors here on the podcast. It has been really eye-opening so far. We have learned so much, and we are really excited to interview you today, Helen.
Well, thank you, Emily. I hope I live up to expectations.
No worries. I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun either way. Helen, I know you have two jobs, because I wrote doctoral researcher and an HR professional. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you do in each job?
I could talk for the next 2 days about what I do within both jobs. So I'll give you a really high level brief. So okay. HR business partnering at the MTC, which is the Manufacturing Technology Center, is absolutely fascinating. The Manufacturing Technology Center is one of seven centers designed to, in essence, catapult manufacturing forward in the UK. We focus on high value manufacturing, and what I do is I business partner with all of our engineering teams. So all those amazing engineers, all the R&D people, I am there to support them with all of their business decisions that relate to people. So that's the essence of the HR business partnering side of things. I'm really fortunate in the fact that the Manufacturing Technology Center fund my PhD.
Yes.
And that PhD is at Loughborough University, which is in the very Midlands of the UK. Mm-hmm. And Loughborough University was one of three universities actually founded and set up, established the Manufacturing Technology Centre. So there's very close links between them. My role as doctoral researcher there is, I'll say simply, but over a period of 6 years on a part-time basis, as well as doing the HRBP role, is to research around gender and identity and authenticity in engineering.
Now, I know you said your employer has supported your PhD by paying for it, which is absolutely incredible. Have they had any say or input in what you're researching, or is that your choice?
That totally my choice, as long as it aligned to engineering. The impact to engineering is absolutely fundamental in everything that we do.
Well, we will definitely talk a little bit more about your PhD a little bit later in the episode. Can you walk us through your career journey to begin with? What did you study in your undergraduate when you got your BA?
So back in the mid-1990s, when the world was a completely different place, my undergraduate was actually in psychology. So a whole variety, breadth and depth of psychology that was undertaken because I really didn't know what I wanted to do in my career. And as a female, although I excelled in maths and in design, I was never given career advice to becoming an engineer. That was never an option for me. So psychology and people is something I've always been fascinated in. So a psychology degree it was.
So you started in psychology. Okay. And that, how did that lead you into, because you went on to get your master's and even your LLM.
I did. So in my 20s, I don't actually think I can say I had a career. I just had a series of jobs. Mm-hmm. And that series of jobs led to working in manufacturing. And it led to an opportunity working in HR. So that series of jobs included all sorts of weird and wonderful things, like working in a florist and being a DJ and working in a box office and working in a care home, recruiting volunteers and managing them. Really sporadic things that have no links at all, apart from what floated my boat at the time. But I think it's proof that for those individuals who are in their 20s or 30s, mm-hmm. you can do all of that stuff and still have a successful career afterwards. There is no pressure or time limit on actually having that career in your 20s and developing it.
I love that. I think it's so true. So true.
And it's a message that needs to be told more and more. So
we tend to think of our 20s as, we idealize it maybe sometimes in our memory. Oh, we were so young. We had so much fun. And then 20 somethings out there are laughing at me, but really, a lot of times in our 20s, we feel a little bit lost. We're not sure what we're doing yet. We're trying out different things. And that is okay. I think that there's
Absolutely.
A lesson to be learned.
Yeah. Absolutely. There are so many expectations. The expectations to buy a house, to meet somebody, yeah. to settle down, to have children, and then to have this high-flying career. And to cram all of that into 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put the pressure on yourself. Do things as it comes naturally. And for me, that natural thing, was to try a load of different things out, mm-hmm. to find out what I actually wanted to do and what I enjoyed. And what I realized was that I love helping people, I love making a difference, and I love seeing other people develop. Mm. So when the opportunity came to work for a French multinational organization, still based in manufacturing and engineering, I joined them and I spent 15 years with them.
Oh, so that must have been a good job. Were you happy there?
It was a fantastic job. Amazing people, to the point where, at the end of those 15 years, despite a whole host of scenarios that could easily be classed as, a sex or gender discrimination,
mm-hmm.
the basis of the job was absolutely fantastic. The impact of the organization was amazing. And it was really difficult to actually make the decision to leave that organization to further my career.
But you did. You did eventually decide to leave.
I did. And that's how I ended up at the Manufacturing Technology Center. And that was in 2017. And I'm currently on secondment to their head office, per se, where I am supporting, creating a new organization, bringing an org chart to life. And I will leave that HQ team in February and go back to the MTC to continue business partnering.
Well, that's exciting. Are you looking forward to that?
It's been a phenomenal year, which includes, obviously, writing the book chapter in that time as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, so Helen, okay, before I go any further, I just do need to ask you one little thing, just a side note. What kind of DJ were you?
Mainly alternative, a lot of skate, punk, However, I did support with a lot of bands being played, so it would then be tailored to the kind of indie alternative music that the band was playing. So
Were you playing at clubs or people's homes or what was it?
Clubs.
Yeah.
All through university, in the sense that we acquired a very large nightclub as part of the Students' Union. And it basically funded me through university. It was brilliant times.
Really? Oh, nice. And I got to say, you still do have that cool look. I know our listeners can't necessarily see you right now, but you got the black rimmed glasses, the black top. So I can see it. It's not so crazy that you were a DJ. All right. Well, Helen, you've mentioned that really there are two parallel journeys that you have been embarking on.
Yes.
And these both relate to being your true self, because authenticity is a huge part of your journey. And so you've got sort of two sections. It's your PhD journey, which is all of your research that you've been doing around these issues, but also your neurodiversity journey. So let's talk about both of those. Let's start with the PhD, because I'd love to hear more about this research. But before we go there, what made you decide to get your PhD?
I guess there are two stories as part of this. When I was much younger, I saw my cousin go to university, and she's always been an inspiration to me. She's phenomenal. And if she listens to this, she knows who she is. I saw her go to university and I wanted to do the same. And I wanted the best thing I could possibly get, which was a PhD. As I grew older, I also understood that actually, I hate all these titles that we have for a female, Miss, Mrs., Ms.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor actually removes all of that, removes that gender side of it. So when you walk into the room as a professional, I'm suddenly Dr. Johnson, not Ms. Helen Johnson. And so there is that innate driver for me in terms of having parity, having equity. But there's also a foundation there in terms of some of those experiences that I've had in manufacturing and engineering that I alluded to earlier. You know, those times where I've gone into site or I've been working in iron foundries or glass manufacturing, as an example, where PPE is only ordered in male sizes. And I know people can't see me, but I'm 5'4" just. Mm-hmm. In the UK, I'm a size 10. So, you know, I'm not slight, but I'm not as big as a male, not as big as your average male. Those sizes drown me. They're not personal. They're definitely not protective. And that's just one example. I've had so many examples of where males have spoken over me in meetings. I've not been allowed to have a voice. Mm-hmm. And when I have had a chance to have a voice, I've been dismissed for a male to then steal what I've said, steal the idea, steal the inspiration, and the male has taken credit for it.
Mm-hmm.
There have been times where my male peers, other managers on the same level as me, have been completely differently treated. So I've been expected to take notes in meetings and make teas and coffees, whereas they would never be asked to do that.
Yeah.
I've had men apologize for swearing in front of me, as if, as an adult, I don't swear or I've never heard it before, which is still baffles me as to
it's a statement on your quote unquote vulnerability or weakness, because you just can't handle.
Absolutely. Well, I can probably swear better than any of them can.
not on this show.
Not on this show. No, I will mind my P's and Q's. yeah, I've had experiences where in job interviews, I've actually almost been patronized by being asked excessively, are you sure you're okay working on a site with 100 men when you might be the only female there? Well, surely I've applied for this role. I've understood the context. I am going through with the interviews. Absolutely. Bring it on. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
Okay. it shouldn't, these are questions that shouldn't have to be asked in this day and age. And on both the gender and the neurodiversity side, I've had to put in place all of those coping strategies. I've had to adapt, which leads me back to the question of, who am I? Do I fit in here? Do I belong here? And I think throughout my journey, and I know from the individuals that I've spoken to within my PhD research, I tried fitting in. I tried being more feminine. I tried wearing the suits and high heels, and I felt even more out of place. And I do believe that the older that we get, the more we find that, I guess, sense of self, and especially the long work that we've been in an organization, you know, we become part of the furniture. And that means that we can feel that we fit in more, that we can perhaps be more authentic. So those journeys sort of intertwine with both the PhD and the neurodiversity.
So that's interesting. Now, these are some of the experiences that you had working in this male-populated industry of engineering, and they led you to want to do further research. So can you talk a little bit about what your PhD is about, what your research is exploring, and how it relates to engineering?
So, long story short.
We have all the time in the world.
You might regret saying that. What fascinates me is why, after decades of research here in the UK, we can't attract more women to engineering. Mm-hmm. So if I look over the last, 12 years, we've increased the percentage of women in engineering about 6.5%. So there is only about 16.5% of that whole engineering workforce that are female. And that's after decades of research, decades of work, decades of ensuring that women have equal access to the qualifications that are required, that we are promoting things within career advice. And throughout my journey as a HR practitioner, I've kept asking myself, why is this? And finally, through my PhD, I've had an opportunity to really explore that. I've gone in with a really open remit, predominantly looking at authenticity, and identity pulls into that, despite the fact that the academic community is completely split in terms of how identity and authenticity actually relate. There's so many complexities within there. And depending on the academic you speak to, they'll give you a different answer. So the opportunity to do the PhD and to actually speak to other engineers to say, what is your experience of the world of work? That has been a phenomenal journey. And as I alluded to, I'm in year six part time. The research has definitely shaped and formed over time, mm-hmm. as I've learned more. And I'm certain by the time I have written my thesis, this massive body of knowledge, which I'll share with you in a moment, will be refined, because I only have 80,000 words to write in this thesis. Mm-hmm. And I'm certain I could write a whole series of books about it, let alone just 80,000 words.
I hope you do.
Oh, I would love nothing more. So if anybody does want to pay me to do that, it would be amazing. The PhD research is probably the easiest part to talk to you about, because that will tell you the information that I've captured. Because the chapter only focuses on half of my PhD.
Okay.
So for the academics that are listening, I'm undertaking a mixed method study, which is both quantitative and qualitative. So for non-academics, basically that means I put out a survey and I've done a load of interviews, mm-hmm. which means I have two studies, not just one, which most people do within, you know, most PhDs. I'm looking at two data sets. I'm looking at two different ideas, and I'm trying to bring those different ideas together to inform each other. So in essence, a survey captures a point in time. It captures how people are feeling on that day. And in the survey that went out nationwide last summer, so in 2022, I captured nearly 500 engineers' experiences and thoughts on their gender identity. So not just the binary of male and female, but the diversity of gender that we have and how they experience that. I captured their thoughts and feelings around engineering identity. So again, that whole breadth and depth of engineering and that whole breadth and depth of length of service and experience in engineering. And then I asked them a series of questions around authenticity, well-being, you know, the organizational climate. So, you know, what is it like to experience, you know, your organization and your gender hand in hand? So are your organization welcoming of your gender? And I captured a whole load of other variables. A lot of them are HR related. So things like commitment, career compromise. So that means, in essence, has your career been compromised in any way, shape or form by the experiences you've had? And I've also looked at what individuals may know as either retention in a role, the turnover of individuals within a role, or their intentions to leave a role. And I've pulled all of this together in a nutshell in the chapter within the book. And there's some really interesting findings which relate to a lot of statistical significance. So after a lot of sometimes heartbreaking and quite tearful moments, because I have done no statistical analysis since the mid-1990s, I have definitely not picked up a statistical piece of software and tried to understand all of these bits. So it's been a massive period of relearning. There has been some really great insights to say that actually those who identify as female experience more career compromise than those who identify as male. Commitment is impacted across both genders. Likewise, as is the exit intentions to leave, you know, retention side of things. And if anyone's interested, you know, grab a copy of the book, because the model that I'm about to explain is in that book, so you can see the graphics. What I'm really interested in is, does the identity interference that is potentially caused by your gender and your occupation identity, so, you know, these two things can come together and conflict with each other. When somebody experiences that conflict, firstly, what is the direct impact on these work outcomes? So on commitment, on career compromise, and on that retention element. All of those lines across that you'll see in a model, in a theoretical model, they're all statistically significant. The really fascinating bit for me says, if you put authenticity in the middle as a mediator, so if you draw this out visually, you will have a box that says identity interference, two boxes which have different kinds of authenticity within those boxes, and then the three work outcomes that I've been talking about, so that commitment, career compromise, and retention. What role does authenticity play? And all bar one of the lines that you draw across from identity interference through authenticity into these three work outcomes would all be statistically significant. So what we're saying is that authenticity plays a role, or may play a role, in the relationship between the identity interference and the work outcomes. So authenticity is really central and really key here.
And so when you say authenticity, are you talking about a person? I'm just going to put it in everyday terms, but are you talking about a person's ability to feel that they are able to be true to themselves as they go about their work and about their interactions with their coworkers?
Absolutely. So there are academic meanings behind it, which I can absolutely explain. But to the layperson, authenticity is that element of being true to yourself. Mm-hmm. And when I talk about self, I link that to identity. So you begin to see that linkage through between identity and authenticity.
Can you give us some examples?
Examples of authenticity in the workplace?
Yeah, maybe some examples of how a person might experience authenticity, the ability to fully execute their authenticity, or some examples of when someone wasn't able to fully feel that they could be themselves in the workplace.
Absolutely. So the other side of my PhD research is, as I said, the interviews, the qualitative side of things. And I was fortunate enough to interview over 40 individuals throughout the period of the summer last year. And I can relay some of the stories that they told me rather than the things that have happened to myself. And as I've been analysing this data, there's some interesting bits, some really fascinating bits coming out at me that I still have to do more analysis into. One of the things that I see within the male respondents is when they talk about authenticity, they talk very much about their values aligned to things that they've been asked to do at work. So an example might be that a manager who is male has been asked to go and work at a different site for a period of time. What the manager knows is that they're actually sent there to either reduce that size of that site, restructure that site, or even close that site. But they can't talk to anybody about it. So when they go into that site, they have to go in, you know, as a manager of that site and in essence lie. So it doesn't align with their own values. Because normally, you know, in any life, in any job, in any role, we wouldn't want to, you know, tell somebody an untruth or, you know, make up a story as to why you are there, why you were engaged, why you're involved in something. Now, women do also experience that. However, a lot of the stories coming from women are actually more about the day-to-day, about not actually feeling and being authentic. And that can link to some of the examples that I gave previously. You know, I can't go into work and dress as me because there is this expectation that I dress in this way. You know, I can't go into work and feel protected wearing PPE because this PPE doesn't fit me. This PPE doesn't allow me to actually be fully protected in this environment.
Right.
And therefore, I don't feel like me. I have to put on this, you know, this act. I don't feel that I can raise my voice in meetings, even though I have some amazing contributions to make. Because I'm being spoken over. Men are answering on my behalf, despite me being the technical expert in this field. And women gave that day-to-day sense that this is impacting them almost every minute of every day. You know, it is okay for a man to work at home, but when a woman does it, actually, they're questioned. Their motives are, do you need to collect the children? Do you need to do the washing? Do you need to put the dishwasher on? Are you actually, you know, doing X, Y, and Z around the house? Whereas men don't get those questions. You know, men can work at home. They are trusted to do these things. And they are not doubted. And women have this, I won't say deeper rooted, but they have a further extended version of feeling inauthentic. There's some other interesting bits coming out of my PhD within the interviews as well. that going back to writing a book may feature, if I get the opportunity to write another chapter or even a book on its own, because there's some fascinating parts that I'm currently exploring that I can't talk about yet because I need the solid evidence.
Yeah.
But when you talk about writing another book, if I can write another book, it will be on this part.
Ooh, okay.
So watch this space.
That's
watch this space.
We will. Now, okay. So I know that you have been doing this for about 6 years, part-time, working on your PhD, and you've done tons of research and you've gathered all this data. Are you at the point yet where you're making recommendations, or is that something that comes down the line?
So I am towards the back end, fingers crossed, I hope, analyzing all of these interviews. Mm-hmm. There is over 40 hours of data there, and I'm undertaking a process called thematic analysis, which is a really iterative process of trying to look for themes of information that is coming through with the with not just the language, but the subject matter that all of my interviews are talking about. And I'm having to look at that from many different angles. So this is a huge piece of work, especially when I am undertaking this on part-time hours, 20 hours a week as such. I am hoping that, I say in the very near future, I will be at the point of bringing these two sets of data, these all of these findings together, and out of that I will start looking at what are the recommendations. I have to condense everything, as I said, to fit it into a thesis. So am I likely to take all of these amazing findings and put them all into my thesis? Probably not. But am I going to take the juiciest ones and make the most of it and enjoy the process? Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the recommendations that I have really, truly considered and in fact presented at a number of different organizations so far are actually around the values piece and thinking about, do we know our values? If we don't know our values, there's a fantastic exercise I recommend within my chapter that anybody can undertake. Really simple, really thought-provoking, and hopefully helps ground people. Because when I say we have to ground ourselves in our values, our words and our actions should align to our values. Because in essence, that is what we look at when we look at other people and say, are they being authentic? So know your values first is my biggest takeaway to the engineering population.
Helen, you, as we talked about a little while ago on the episode, you had a double journey. It was a parallel journey between your PhD and your own discovery that you had a diagnosis of autism as well as ADHD. So I know you have mentioned that they link together, these two things link together, your PhD and your diagnoses. What was that like for you to come to this diagnosis, you said at the age of 46?
It was a light bulb moment. For anybody else who has received a diagnosis as an adult at any age, or is self-diagnosed and aligns to any form of, say, neurodivergence, it was an absolute light bulb moment, because you finally understand why you feel the way that you feel and why some of the things that you do are very different to how you perceive other people doing stuff. Mm-hmm. Why you struggle with some of the very, very simple things in life, but can do the really complex things. Mm-hmm. And for me, it also made a lot of sense as to why I'm really attracted and really find myself at home working in male-dominated environments, especially engineering. Because more recent research has told us that within engineering, there is 3 times the prevalence of autistic individuals working in that profession than really? Any other profession. And it's one of the reasons I also shout about my diagnosis, because autism has this, as well as ADHD, has this massive stigma around it. where some individuals believe that it doesn't exist, all the way through to individuals believing that actually with that diagnosis, you can't do anything. But I'm sat here, hopefully living proof that not only can you have a successful career, you can have a successful academic career too. And actually the strengths of autism and ADHD play out in the ideas, the creativity, the passion, the drive, that special interest, that ability to really focus and to drive home, you know, take all of this big information and pull it together. There are so many strengths that align with, you know, the traits and the characteristics of autism and ADHD that they far outweigh any of the weaknesses that people perceive. It doesn't mean the weaknesses don't exist, but the strengths absolutely outweigh them.
It's so interesting. So have you made these connections as part of your thesis as well? Or are you just, is this a personal discovery that you're focusing on mainly just as part of your own journey?
Yeah, I think I now truly understand why I chose the subject matter that I chose. Mm-hmm. Because actually, the questions in my head throughout my career of, do I belong here? Do I fit in? Who am I? Am I me because I'm a product of my environment? Or actually, if I went off, you know, in a parallel universe, if there is another Helen, you know, who is exactly the same as me, but has done something different, would she be exactly the same or would she be different? Question mark. Mm-hmm. What I know and what I understand so far on this, you know, albeit brief journey, because I've not even had my 1 year anniversary of diagnosis. But a lot of females, not only do they present very differently, but they tend to align more to men. They might have, you know, better friendships with males. They might be a tomboy. They might enjoy more, and I'll say, you know, male-dominated hobbies or pastimes. Mm-hmm. So there is an element there that connects PhD, you know, and working life and my own personal journey.
Do you talk about this in your chapter as well?
I do mention it. I said I'm very open about it. I focus the chapter predominantly on the PhD, the research, and how it can actually benefit other people. But mm-hmm. absolutely, part and parcel of my chapter is my story, my journey, because it links so heavily with the PhD.
Well, let's talk about the book, Empowering Women in STEM, Working Together to Inspire the Future. What is the name of your chapter?
Absolutely inspirational. Female and engineer, question mark. And for the academics out there, I followed that with exploring the gender occupation identity dilemma in engineering.
Yes. So it tells us a little bit more about what it's about. And I think anyone who has seen this episode is going to want to dig into that and see the graphics and everything else that you parsed out in the chapter. But I want to know, Helen, what was just the experience like for you? Have you written autobiographically before?
Absolutely not. So this was phenomenal. It was amazing to write. A colleague said to me a couple of years ago that my PhD would result in a book. Mm-hmm. I actually got to tell her not that long ago that so far it's resulting in a book chapter, which is amazing. So, you know, her prediction has come true.
Yeah.
I shied away from writing. Partly, I think, because of an imposter syndrome, in the fact that who would be interested? You know, there's little old me sat here as a HR business partner, you know, in the Midlands of the UK. Who's interested in my story? But now I actually get to tell the story of, you know, 500 engineers. I get to tell the story of the experiences they've had. So I can use that voice to hopefully benefit anybody working in engineering.
But your story is just as valuable. So I'm glad that you're also telling your own story. It's
Thank
all
you.
valuable. What's next for you? What do you have planned?
The PhD is the biggest thing in my life.
Yes.
Getting that finished will be, an adventure, a challenge, all of its own. As well as returning to the Manufacturing Technology Centre next February. So I can quite often be found saying, I don't know what exists after my PhD,
Yeah.
because actually, I don't know. I say I don't know. There's a whole host of things that I would love to do. I would love the opportunity to write more. I would love the opportunity to research more. But I think the thing that underpins everything that I do goes back to that impact, that making a difference, that developing other people. And if I had one dream, it would be to take my findings and to create that positive impact within the UK, possibly wider. What I need for that is the network. What I need for that is some funding. What I need for that is, the time, all the things that aren't necessarily the easiest things to get, to find, to commit to. But I guess, that's the dream. Most people don't do a PhD to have it sit in a depository online somewhere or on a bookshelf. They do it to create that impact. That impact has, I guess, started in some ways because individuals who I've interviewed have had realizations, have had those light bulb moments. What I want to be able to do is create more impact. And so
And this
again,
certainly, yeah. Sorry.
this is a watch your space thing because
Yes.
I don't know who will listen to this. I don't know what opportunities are out there. And when you are so engrossed in actually writing, researching and writing within a PhD, some of those opportunities may pass you by because you can't raise your head to take time to look for those things.
Well, now you've got all of the readers of the new book that's coming up that will be paying closer attention to you and your work. So that's good. And let's tell our listeners where they can find the book. First of all, you can go to Amazon. You can pre-order the book right now, and you will get that in the mail on March 1st. Or you can go to Sanya Mathura, the author, the editor and author of the architect, let's say, of the book, at strategicreliabilitysolutions.com. And I just want to thank you so much, Helen, for being here. This has been really fun. And just, I want to say I'm just chomping at the bit to actually read your chapter, but also I know that in the future you're going to have a lot more coming. I can just imagine all these books that you're going to write on the research that you've done. So thank you so much for being here. Helen Sarah Johnson, doctoral researcher and HR business partner at with Manufacturing Technology Center, and of course, contributing author to the new book, Empowering Women in STEM, Working Together to Inspire the Future.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
You have been listening to the Hazard Girls podcast on Jacket Media, sponsored by Juno Jones, the stylish safety boot company. That's junojonesshoes.com. And you can go there to learn about our steel toe boots and to join the Hazard Girls community. I'm your host, Emily Salaby. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.